Welcome to Cramming for Creogs. I'm John.
And I'm John.
And we're excited to have you with us today. Let's kick off the week with a quick review on management of endometrial cells on cervical cytology. There are three big situations here to remember. First is the finding of benign endometrial cells on cervical cytology. This is only required to be reported in patients older than 40 years old. If your patient is premenopausal, don't worry about it and resume routine screening. However, if she's postmenopausal, then endometrial assessment is warranted, given an increased risk for endometrial cancer. The second situation is that of atypical endometrial cells, which requires endometrial and endocervical sampling. If these both come back negative, then colposcopy is warranted to figure out your etiology. The third and last is the finding of atypical glandular cells, or AGC, not including the atypical endometrial cells. Everybody with this finding requires a colposcopy with endocervical curettage. In addition, endometrial sampling is recommended only for those greater than 35 years old or with risk factors for endometrial neoplasia. All right, a quick review on the management of DCIS. The important thing to remember is that DCIS has a low malignant potential, with a 20-year breast cancer-specific mortality rate of approximately 3.3%, and that low mortality rate really drives management. When looking at the treatment options, the big three are mastectomy, lumpectomy with radiation, and lumpectomy alone, with 10-year local recurrence rates going from 2.6% to 13% to 28% respectively, but survival outcomes are equivalent. Given such high overall survival and similar survival outcomes between surgical options, mastectomy is typically considered too aggressive. Interesting to note, the radiation following lumpectomy can be deferred if the tumor is less than 2.5 centimeters, with low-grade histology and negative margins because of a less than 1% risk of 10-year mortality in this situation. So all in all, lumpectomy with radiation is typically the way to go unless you have reasons otherwise.
Let's talk about the diagnostic criteria for antiphospholipid syndrome. Any number of clinical criteria that are met should raise suspicion to go ahead and test with laboratory findings for antiphospholipid syndrome. The clinical criteria can kind of be divided into two parts. The first, having any episode of arterial, venous, or small vessel thrombosis, or second, any form of pregnancy morbidity that is thought to be due to the placenta. So, for example, at least one unexplained death of a fetus at or beyond 10 weeks of gestation with normal fetal morphology, three or more unexplained consecutive spontaneous ABs before 10 weeks of pregnancy, or at least one preterm birth prior to 34 weeks thought to be secondary to severe preeclampsia or features consistent with placental insufficiency. Laboratory criteria that lock down the diagnosis of APLS include lupus anticoagulant present in the plasma that flags positive on two or more occasions at least 12 weeks apart, anticardiolipin antibody that's greater than the 99th percentile also on two or more occasions at least 12 weeks apart, and finally anti-beta 2 glycoprotein 1 IgG or IgM that is greater than 99th percentile and also present on two or more occasions at least 12 weeks apart.
I'm Liv.
And I'm Kat.
And we're the interns.
Thanks for joining us.